Laws, Book 6, A Dialogue of Athenian with Cleinias and Megalus.
Well, after everything we've just said, we're pretty much ready to set up the offices of government for your city.
So it seems.
There are two aspects to organizing a constitution. First, establishing the offices and the office holders, how many there should be and how they're to be appointed. Second, assigning to each office the laws it needs, which ones, how many, and what kind fit each office. But before we get to the selection process, let's pause and say something relevant about it.
What's that?
This, it's obvious to everyone that lawgiving is a great undertaking, but if you put unsuitable officials in charge of a well-prepared city with well-made laws, it's not just that the good laws bring no benefit. It isn't merely that a great deal of ridicule would follow, but the damage and harm done to the cities would be about the greatest there is.
How could it be otherwise?
So let's think through how this applies to the constitution and city we're building now, my friend. You see that first, those who properly move toward positions of power must have given adequate proof of themselves and their family, from childhood right up to the moment of selection. And second, those who are going to do the choosing must have been raised in the customs of law, well-educated, so that they're capable of judging correctly whom to reject and whom to accept, deciding rightly who deserves which position. But how could people who have only just come together, who don't know one another, and who haven't yet been educated, ever manage to choose office holders without fault?
They pretty much couldn't.
But they say a contest doesn't much accept excuses. And that's exactly the position you and I are in now, since you've committed, as you say, to settling this city for the Cretan people, you and nine others, and I in turn am to help you with the story we're telling at present. I certainly wouldn't willingly leave a story headless, wandering about like that, it would look shapeless.
Well said, stranger.
Not only well said, I'll actually do it as far as I'm able.
Then let's do exactly what we're saying.
It will happen, God willing, and as long as we can hold off old age that much longer.
It's likely the God will be willing.
Likely indeed. Following that thought, let's take up this point too.
What point?
How boldly and riskily our city is being founded right now.
What exactly are you looking at, and where is this remark of yours pointed?
At how easily and fearlessly we're legislating for men with no experience of law, not knowing how they'll eventually take to the laws we're now laying down. This much, Cleinias, is clear to nearly anyone, even someone not terribly wise. People won't readily accept these laws right from the start. But if we could somehow hold out long enough for children raised on these laws from birth, thoroughly steeped in them, familiar with them, to take part alongside the whole city in choosing its officials. Then, if that happened, and happened correctly by whatever means or method, I think there would be great security, even beyond that initial period, that the city so nurtured would endure.
That certainly makes sense.
Let's look then at whether we can find some adequate way toward this. I say, Cleinias, that the people of Knossos, more than the other Cretans, ought not just to fulfill their religious duty regarding this land you're now settling, but should give intense attention, as far as they're able, to establishing the first offices as securely and excellently as possible. The other offices are a smaller task, but choosing our first guardians of the laws is the most urgent business of all, requiring every effort.
What method, then, and what reasoning do we find for this?
Here it is, I say, children of Crete, that the Gnossians, because their city is senior to the many others, ought jointly with those who have come to join this new settlement, drawn from both groups, choose 37 in all, 19 from the new settlers, the rest from Knossos itself. The Gnossians should give these to your city, and you yourself should be a citizen of this colony, one of the 18, whether they persuade you or use their modest power to compel you.
Why then, stranger, don't you and Megalus join us in this citizenship?
Athens thinks highly of itself, Cleinias, and so does Sparta, and both live far away as colonizers. But everything fits properly for you, and for the other founders in the same way, as has just been said about you, So let's say this is the fairest arrangement we can make from what's available to us now. As time goes on and the Constitution holds firm, let the selection of officials be as follows. Everyone who bears arms, cavalry, or infantry, and has taken part in war within the ranges appropriate to their age, shall share in choosing the officials. The selection should take place in whatever temple the city holds most honored. Each person shall bring to the god's altar a tablet on which he has written a name, along with the father's name, and the tribe and deme the candidate belongs to, and shall add his own name in the same way beside it. Anyone who wishes may take up any tablet that doesn't strike him as rightly written and display it in the marketplace for no less than 30 days. The tablets judged best, up to 300, shall be shown to the whole city by the officials, and the city shall again vote from among these for whomever each person wants. Those who come out on top a second time, 100 of them, shall again be shown to everyone. For the third round, from the 100, anyone who wishes may cast a vote for whomever he wants, passing between the sacrificial victims. Then 37, whoever receives the most votes, shall be judged and declared officials. But who, Cleinias and Megalus, will set all of this up in the city regarding the offices and their scrutiny? Do we realize that in cities being yoked together for the first time like this, there must be some people to do it, yet there can't yet be anyone who has already held every office. There must be such people somehow, and not mediocre ones, but the very best available. As the saying goes, a good beginning is half of every task, and we all praise a fine start on every occasion. And it's actually more than half, in my view. No one has ever praised a truly good beginning adequately enough.
Quite right.
So let's not pass over it in silence, as if we didn't understand it, without explaining clearly to ourselves how it's to be done. For my part, I have no resource to offer except one thing, necessary and useful for our present purpose.
What's that?
I say that for this city we're about to settle, there is no father or mother except the city that is founding it, though I'm well aware that many colonies have often turned out, and will turn out, at odds with their founding cities. But for now, in the present moment, like a child who, even if he's destined one day to be at odds with his parents, in the current helplessness of childhood loves and is loved by those who bore him, and always fleeing to his relatives, finds in them his only necessary allies. So I say the Gnossians now stand ready, through their care for the new city and the new city toward Gnossus. I repeat, as I just said, repeating something good does no harm, that the Gnossians must attend to all this jointly, choosing from among those who have come to the colony, selecting the oldest and best as far as possible, no fewer than 100 men, and let there be 100 more from the Gnossians themselves. These, once they've come to the new city, must jointly see to it that the offices are established according to law, and once established, that they're properly scrutinized. Once this is done, the Gnossians shall dwell in Gnossus, and the new city shall try to preserve and prosper on its own. As for the 37 who are chosen, both now and for all future time, let them be selected on these terms. First, let them be guardians of the laws. Second, guardians of the written declarations each person submits to the officials regarding the extent of his property. Except that the man with the highest assessment shall declare 4 minas, the second 3, the third 2 minas, and the fourth 1 mina. If anyone is found possessing anything beyond what he's declared, the excess shall become public property, and in addition, he shall be liable to prosecution by anyone who wishes to bring it, in a suit that is neither honorable nor well-named, but shameful, if he's convicted of despising the laws for the sake of profit. Whoever wishes, may indict him for sordid greed and pursue the case before the guardians of the laws themselves. If the defendant is convicted, he shall have no share in common property, and whenever some distribution is made to the city, he shall be excluded from it, except for his allotted portion, and it shall be recorded that he was convicted, for as long as he lives, in a place where anyone who wishes may read it. No one shall hold the office of guardian of the laws for more than 20 years, and no one shall be brought forward for the office who is younger than 50. If someone is brought forward at 60, he shall hold office for only 10 years, and by this same reasoning, whoever lives beyond 70 should no longer think of holding so weighty an office among these officials, as though he still meant to serve. Let these, then, be the three regulations stated concerning the guardians of the laws. As the laws proceed further, each will assign to these men whatever additional duties they must attend to beyond what's been said now. For the moment, let's go on to speak of the selection of other offices. After this, we must choose generals, and for them, assistants for war such as cavalry commanders, tribal commanders of horse, and organizers of the infantry tribes' formations, for whom this very name would suit best, just as most people call them company commanders. As for generals, let the guardians of the laws nominate them from this city itself, and let all who have shared in war, both those currently and those successively of military age, choose from among the nominees. If anyone thinks someone not nominated is better than one of those nominated, he may name whom he wants in place of whom, swearing to it, and put forward this alternative candidate. Whichever of the two wins on a show of hands shall be entered into the selection. The three who receive the most votes shall be generals and overseers of matters of war, once scrutinized just as the guardians of the laws are. The elected generals shall nominate company commanders for themselves, 12 in all, one commander per tribe, and the same process of counter-nomination that applied to the generals shall apply to the company commanders too, along with the same voting and judgment. For now, before the presiding officers and council have been chosen, let the guardians of the laws convene this assembly, seating it in the most sacred and suitable place available, with the hoplites seated separately, the cavalry separately, and third, alongside these all who bear arms of whatever kind. Let all the citizens vote for generals and cavalry commanders, but let those who bear the shield choose the company commanders, and let the whole body of cavalry in turn choose the tribal commanders for these same men. As for the leaders of the light-armed troops, the archers, or any other branch of the fighting forces, let the generals appoint these for themselves. There remains for us still the appointment of the cavalry commanders. Let the same men who nominated the generals nominate these two, and let the selection and the counter-nomination proceed in the very same way as it did for the generals. But let the cavalry cast the vote for them in full view of the infantry, and let the two who receive the most votes be commanders of all the horsemen. Disputes over the voting may be raised twice, but if anyone disputes a third time, let those whose task it was to judge the measure of each vote decide the matter by ballot. As for the council, let it consist of 30 times 12, that is, 360, a number well suited to being divided up. Dividing them into four groups of 90 according to the property classes, let each class return 90 counselors. First, from the highest property class, let all be required to vote, on pain of a fine to be fixed, for anyone who refuses to comply, and once they have voted, let the names be sealed up, and on the next day, let voting proceed from the second property class in the same manner as before. On the third day, let anyone who wishes vote from the third class, though it be compulsory only for members of the top three classes, while the fourth and smallest class shall be free to abstain from voting without penalty. On the fourth day, let all vote from the fourth and smallest class, but let anyone from the third or fourth class who does not wish to vote go unpunished, whereas anyone from the second or first class who fails to vote shall be fined, the man from the second class 3 times the first fine, the man from the first class 4 times. On the fifth day, let the magistrates bring out the sealed names for all the citizens to see, and let every man vote again from among these, on pain of the first fine. Then, having selected 180 from each property class, let them determine by lot which half of these shall undergo scrutiny, and let these be the counselors for the year. A selection carried out in this way would strike a middle course between a monarchic and a democratic constitution, and a constitution ought always to steer a middle course between the two. For slaves and masters could never become friends, nor could the base and the worthy if ranked with equal honors, since for unequal people equal treatment becomes unequal unless it hits the right measure. It is through both these errors that constitutions become filled with civil strife. There is an old saying, and a true one, that equality produces friendship, very rightly and fittingly said. But just what this equality is that has such power is far from clear, and this greatly confuses us. For there are two equalities, bearing the same name, but in practice almost opposite in effect. The first, any city and any lawgiver is capable of applying to the distribution of honors, the equality of measure, weight, and number, meted out by lot. But the truest and best equality is not so easy for everyone to see. It is the judgment of Zeus, and it is granted to human beings only sparingly, yet whatever portion of it is granted to cities or to individuals produces every good thing. For to the greater it gives more, to the lesser less, apportioning to each what is fitting to its own nature. And in particular, it always grants greater honors to those of greater virtue, while to those of the opposite character it assigns what is proper to each in due proportion to their virtue and education. This surely is for us always the very essence of political justice, and it is toward this we must now strain, Cleinias, and it is to this equality we must look as we settle the city now coming into being. Whoever founds another city at some future time must likewise legislate with this same goal in view, not with an eye to few tyrants, or to one man, or to some power of the people, but always with an eye to justice. And this, as I have just said, is the equal naturally given, each time, to unequal things. Yet it is necessary that every city, even so, make use at times of these very things that share the name of equality only by courtesy, if it is not to have some part of itself infected with civil strife. For fairness and forgiveness are always a departure from the perfect and exact standard of strict justice whenever they occur. That is why it is necessary to make use of the equality of the lot, on account of the discontent of the many, calling upon God and good fortune in our prayers to guide the lot itself toward what is most just. In this way, then, both equalities must be used out of necessity, but the one that depends on chance, as sparingly as possible. This, friends, is what a city that means to survive must do, for these reasons. And since a ship sailing on the sea needs watch kept day and night without pause, and a city likewise, tossed among the waves of other cities and living always in danger of being caught by plots of every kind, must join magistrate to magistrate and guard to guard, passing the watch on continuously from day into night, and from night back into day, never letting it lapse, since a large body can never act quickly in any of these matters. It is necessary to let most of the counselors remain for most of the time at their own private affairs, managing their own households in good order, while a twelfth part of them, distributed over 12 months, one part for each month, serve as guards, ready to meet at once anyone who comes from elsewhere or from within the city itself, whether someone wishes to bring a report or to inquire about something the city ought to answer to other cities, or to receive answers when it has itself put questions to others. And also, since disturbances of every kind are always liable to arise within a city, this body must see, so far as possible, that they do not arise at all, and if they do arise, that the city becomes aware of it, and the trouble is cured as swiftly as can be. For these reasons, there must always be this presiding body of the city with authority to convene assemblies and to dissolve them, both the regular ones and those suddenly forced upon the city. All this, then, would be the business of the 12th part of the council that is on duty, while the other 11 parts rest through the rest of the year. This portion of the council must, in common with the other officials, keep these watches over the city continually. So much for arrangements within the city itself, which would be tolerably well ordered. But what care and what organization shall there be for the rest of the countryside? Now that the whole city and the whole territory has been divided into 12 parts, must there not be appointed overseers of the roads within the city, the houses, the buildings, the harbors, the marketplace, the springs, and further, of the sacred precincts and temples and all such things?
Of course there must.
Let us say, then, that for the temples there must be temple wardens, priests, and priestesses, and for the roads, buildings, and the good order relating to such things, both to keep human beings from wrongdoing and other creatures too, within the city's own enclosure and its outskirts, so that whatever is fitting for cities may come about, three kinds of officials must be chosen, for the matter just mentioned, those called city wardens, and for the good order of the marketplace, market wardens. As for priests of the temples, wherever there are hereditary priesthoods, male or female, these should not be disturbed. But where, as is likely at first for new settlers, there is no one holding such office, or only a few, priests and priestesses must be appointed as temple wardens for the gods. Of all these, some must be chosen by election and others by lot in the various appointments, mixing together in friendship in each district and city, both the common people and those who are not, so that there may be the greatest possible harmony. As for the priesthoods, leaving to the god himself the choice of what pleases him, one should assign them by lot, thus surrendering the matter to divine fortune, but should scrutinize whoever is chosen each time, first, that he be whole in body and legitimate in birth, next, that he come as far as possible from households kept pure, free from blood guilt, and from all offenses of that kind against the divine, and that he himself and his father and mother have likewise lived their lives blamelessly. One should bring the laws concerning all divine matters from Delphi, and having appointed interpreters over them, make use of these. Let each priesthood last 1 year and no longer, and let the man who is to perform the sacred rites, adequately according to the sacred laws concerning divine matters, be not less than 60 years old, and let the same rules apply to priestesses. As for the interpreters, let the 4 tribes each put forward 4 candidates 3 times, 1 from their own number each time, and let 3 of these, whoever received the most votes, after scrutiny, be sent 9 in all to Delphi, 1 chosen from each group of 3, and let their scrutiny and the age required be the same as for the priests. Let these men be interpreters for life, and when one of them departs, let the 4 tribes choose a replacement from the tribe he came from. As for treasurers in charge of the sacred funds belonging to each of the temples, the precincts, their produce, and their leases, let 3 be chosen from the highest property class for the greatest temples, 2 for the lesser ones, and 1 for the most modest, and let the selection and scrutiny of these proceed just as it did for the generals. Let this, then, be the arrangement concerning sacred matters. Let nothing, so far as possible, be left unguarded. As for the guarding of the city, let it proceed in this manner, under the oversight of the generals, the company commanders, the cavalry commanders, the tribal commanders, and the presiding officers, as well as the city wardens and market wardens, once these have been duly elected and installed. And let the rest of the countryside be guarded entirely as follows. The whole territory has been divided for us, as far as possible, into 12 equal parts, and let 1 tribe, assigned by lot to each part, provide annually 5 men to serve, so to speak, as rural commanders and guard captains, and let each of these 5 be permitted to enlist from his own tribe 12 young men, not less than 25 years old, and not more than 30. Let the districts of the territory be assigned to these by lot, month by month, so that all may become experienced and knowledgeable about the whole territory. Let the term of office and of guard duty last 2 years for both the guards and their commanders. However the parts fall to them at first, let the guard captains lead them, moving on each month to the next district in a circle to the right, and let to the right mean toward the east. When the year has gone round, in the 2nd year, so that as many of the guards as possible may become familiar with the territory not merely in 1 season of the year, but so that as many as possible may also learn what happens at each season in each district. Those who led the way before shall now lead in reverse, always shifting to the district on the left, and continuing in this fashion until the second year is done. In the third year, let other rural commanders be chosen, and let the 5 who had charge of the 12 be replaced. Now, as for the daily business at each post, the general care should run along these lines. First, that the land be as well defended against enemies as possible, digging trenches wherever needed, cutting counterditches, and using fortified works as far as they can to block anyone who tries to damage the land or the property in it. For this work, they should use the pack animals and servants available at each post, directing the work through them and supervising them, while keeping their own labor free from it as much as possible. They should make every route as hard to pass as they can for enemies, and as easy as possible for friends, for people, pack animals, and herds alike, tending the roads so that each becomes as smooth as it can be. As for the water that falls from Zeus, they must see that it does no harm to the land, but rather benefits it. Where it runs down from the heights into the hollow ravines in the mountains, they should block its outflow with buildings and trenches, so that by receiving and holding the rain that comes from Zeus, it creates streams and springs for all the fields and places below, and turns even the driest spots well-watered and abundant. The springheads themselves, whether a river or a spring, they should make more attractive with plantings and buildings, gathering the waters together through channels so as to make them plentiful for all. And if there happens to be a grove or a sacred precinct set apart nearby, they should direct the streams into it, right into the shrines of the gods, and so adorn them, drawing water there at every season. Everywhere in such places, the young men must build gymnasiums for themselves, and warm baths for the old, providing plenty of dry, seasoned wood, so as to give a warm welcome to bodies worn down by illness or by farm labor. A reception better, by a good margin, than a not very skilled doctor's care. All this and everything like it will bring both beauty and benefit to these places, done in a spirit of no ungracious play. But here is where serious effort must go. Each company of 60 is to guard its own district, not only against enemies, but against any who claim to be friends as well. When one neighbor wrongs another, whether slave or free, among neighbors and other citizens, the 5 commanders of that district are to judge the smaller cases themselves. The greater ones, up to 3 minas, they judge together with the 12, making 17 judges, for whatever charges one party brings against another. But no judge or official is to render judgment or hold office free of future accounting, except those who hold the final authority, such as the kings. And further, if these rural officers commit any abuse toward those in their charge, giving unequal orders, or attempting to take and carry off produce from the farms without consent, or accepting some gift as a bribe, or handing down unjust rulings, then for yielding to flattery let them carry public disgrace throughout the whole city. But for other wrongs they commit against people in their district, up to the value of a mina, let them submit willingly to trial among the villagers and neighbors involved. For greater wrongs, or even lesser ones, if they refuse to submit, trusting that by rotating monthly to a new post each time they can keep escaping trial by fleeing forward, the wronged party may bring a public suit against them. And if he wins, let the one who tried to escape and refused to submit willingly to punishment pay double. The officers and the rural guards are to conduct their common life during these 2 years in the following way. First, in each district, there are to be common messes, where all must take their meals together. Anyone who misses a meal on any day or sleeps away at night, without orders from the officers or some overriding necessity, if the 5 report him and post a notice in the marketplace naming him as one who has abandoned his watch, is to bear public disgrace as a betrayer of his city's cause, and may be beaten by anyone who happens on him and wishes to punish him, with no liability for doing so. If one of the officers themselves does anything of this kind, all 60 must see to it. And whoever notices or learns of it and fails to prosecute is to be liable under these same laws and fined more heavily than the younger men and stripped of all future eligibility for offices held by the young. Over all this, the guardians of the laws must keep close watch, so that such offenses either do not occur, or when they do occur, meet with the justice they deserve. Every man must hold this conviction about all human beings, that one who has never served cannot become a master worthy of praise, and that a man should take more pride in serving well than in ruling well, first in service to the laws, since this is service to the gods, and then always in service to elders and to those who have lived honorably. After this, the man who has held the post of rural guard must, during these 2 years, have tasted the plain and needy way of daily living. For once the 12 have been enrolled, they should meet together with the 5 and take counsel, so that, like servants, they will have no other servants or slaves of their own, nor will they make use of the other farmers and villagers as attendants for their private errands, but only for public matters. In everything else, they must plan to live by serving one another and being served by one another, and besides this, to range over the whole countryside, summer and winter, under arms, for the sake of guarding and coming to know every part of it at all times. For there is, I think, no lesson of greater value than for everyone to know his own country thoroughly and with precision. For this reason, the young man ought to pursue hunting and every other form of the chase no less than other pleasures, along with the benefit that comes with such pursuits for everyone. These men, then, and their occupation, whether one calls them rangers or rural guards or whatever name one prefers, every man who intends to keep his city properly safe should pursue eagerly to the extent of his power. Next in order for us was the choice of officials concerning market wardens and city wardens. Following the rural guards, who are 60 in number, should come city wardens, 3 in number, dividing the city into 3 of the 12 districts, imitating the others by tending the roads within the city and the highways leading in from the country that run continually toward it, and the buildings, so that all are built according to law, and also the water supplies, whatever water the country guards send and hand over to them, properly treated, so that it flows to the fountains sufficient and pure, thereby adorning and benefiting the city at once. These men, too, must be capable and have the leisure to attend to public affairs. So every man should nominate whomever he wishes as city warden from among those of the highest property class, once the vote has narrowed the field to 6 who receive the most votes. Let those in charge of this draw lots among them for 3, who then take office after being examined according to the laws set for them. Market wardens are to be chosen next in the same manner, 5 men from the second and first property classes, the rest of the selection proceeding just as for the city wardens. 10 are voted forward from among the rest, and 5 are drawn by lot from those 10, and once examined, they are declared to hold office. Every man is to cast a vote in all these elections. Whoever refuses, if reported to the officials, is to be fined 50 drachmas in addition to gaining a reputation for bad citizenship. Anyone who wishes may attend the assembly and the general gathering, but it is compulsory for those of the second and first property classes, under penalty of 10 drachmas if they are not present and found at the gatherings. For the third and fourth classes, it is not compulsory, and they are excused without penalty, unless the officials issue an order for everyone to assemble because of some special necessity. The market wardens are to guard the order of the marketplace as laid down by law, and look after the shrines and fountains in the marketplace, so that no one commits any wrong there, and they are to punish the wrongdoer with blows and confinement if he is a slave or a foreigner. But if a native commits such disorder, the market wardens themselves have authority to judge and fine up to 100 drachmas, and up to double that amount jointly with the city wardens, judging the wrongdoer together. The city wardens are to have the same powers of fine and punishment within their own office, fining up to a mina on their own, and up to double that jointly with the market wardens. Next after this, it would be fitting to establish officials over music and over athletics, two kinds for each, one set for education, the other for competitions. By education, the law means overseers of the gymnasiums and schools, who look after their order and discipline, and also after the attendance and lodging of boys and girls. By competition, it means judges who award prizes to competitors in athletic contests and in music alike, again two kinds, one for music, another for athletic contests. For the athletic contests of men and horses, the same judges will serve. But for music, it would be fitting to have different judges for solo and imitative performance, such as reciters, singers to the lyre, flute players, and all such performers, and yet others for choral performance. First, then, officials must be chosen for the entertainment provided by choruses of boys, men, and girls, in their dances, and in all the musical arrangement involved. One official is sufficient for them, provided he is not younger than 40. One is likewise sufficient for solo performance, provided he is not younger than 30, serving as presenter and giving a fair judgment among the competitors. The chorus official and arranger should be chosen in the following way. All who are warmly disposed toward such matters should attend the assembly, on penalty for not attending, the guardians of the laws being judges of this, while for everyone else, if they do not wish to attend, nothing is compulsory. The one making the nomination must do so from among men experienced in the matter, and in the scrutiny, this single point should count both for and against a candidate, that the one drawn is either inexperienced or experienced in this. Whoever is drawn as one of 10 who have been voted forward, once examined, is to direct the choruses for the year according to law. In the same manner and on the same terms, whoever is drawn is to preside for that year over the judging of solo and ensemble instrumental performances submitted for competition, handing over the decision to the judges. After this, judges for athletic competition must be chosen for contests of horses and men at the gymnasiums, from the third and even the second property classes. For this election, it is compulsory for the three highest classes to attend and vote, while the lowest class is excused without penalty. Three are to be chosen by lot, from 20 voted forward beforehand, drawing the three from the 20 whom the vote of the examiners then approves. If anyone is rejected in the examination for any office or judgeship, others are to be chosen in his place by the same process, and the examination conducted for them in the same way. The remaining official concerning the matters mentioned is the overseer of all education, for girls and boys alike. Let there be one man to hold this office by law, not younger than 50 years of age, and the father of legitimate children, sons and daughters ideally, or failing that, one or the other. Both the man selected and the one making the selection must bear in mind that this office is, by far, the greatest of the highest offices in the city. Every plant, if its first shoot springs up well, has the greatest power of bringing its own nature to the fulfillment proper to it. This holds for other plants, for tame and wild animals, and for human beings alike. Man, we say, is a tame creature, and yet, if he happens on the right upbringing and a fortunate nature, he tends to become the most divine and tame of all living things, while if he is raised inadequately or badly, he becomes the wildest thing the earth produces. For this reason, the lawgiver must not let the rearing of children become a secondary matter or an afterthought. He must begin by seeing that whoever is to take charge of it is well chosen, the best person in the city at everything, so far as that can be managed, must be appointed and set over them as overseer. So all the offices, except the council and the presiding officers, shall proceed to Apollo's temple, and there cast a secret ballot for whichever of the guardians of the laws each thinks would make the best director of education. Whoever gets the most votes, once he has been examined and approved by the other officials who did the choosing, excepting the guardians of the laws themselves, shall serve a term of 5 years. In the sixth, another shall be chosen to this office by the same method. If someone dies while holding a public office, with more than 30 days remaining before his term would have ended, those whose proper business it is shall appoint a replacement to the office in the same manner. And if a guardian of orphans dies, the relatives who live in the city, on both the father's and the mother's side as far as cousins' children, shall appoint another within 10 days, or else each shall be fined a drachma a day until they have appointed a guardian for the children. Every city, surely, would become no city at all if its courts were not properly established. A judge who says nothing, who speaks no more than the litigants themselves during preliminary hearings, as happens in private arbitrations, could never be competent to render judgment on matters of justice. That is why it is not easy for a large body of judges to render good judgment, nor for a small and inferior one either. What is in dispute must always be made clear from both sides, and time, unhurried procedure, and repeated examination all help bring the matter in dispute out into the open. For these reasons, first, those who bring charges against one another should go to their neighbors, and to friends and people who know the facts as well as possible about the disputed actions. If someone does not get a satisfactory judgment there, let him go to another court. And third, should the matter still be unresolved after two courts, a final tribunal shall bring the case to its close. In a certain way, the establishment of courts is itself a form of choosing officials, for every official must also be a judge of some matters, and a judge, even though not an official, becomes, in a certain sense, a not insignificant official on the day he brings a case to judgment. So let us treat judges as officials too, and say who would be suitable, and over what matters, and how many judges should preside over each. Let the highest court be the one that each set of disputants appoints for themselves, choosing certain persons in common. Of the remaining two tribunals, let one apply when one private citizen, accusing another of wrongdoing, wants to bring him to trial for judgment, and the other when someone believes the public has been wronged by one of the citizens and wishes to come to the defense of the community. Here, too, we must say what sort of judges these should be. Let our first court, then, be the one common to all private citizens disputing with one another for the third time, established as follows. All the officials, both those who hold office for a year and those who hold it longer, when a new year is about to begin after the summer solstice, in the following month, on the day before that day, all the officials must gather together in one temple, and having sworn an oath to the god, offer up, as it were, first fruits from every office, one judge, whoever from each office seems best, and likely to judge the citizens' cases most excellently and most righteously through the coming year. Once these are chosen, there shall be an examination among the very officials who chose them, and if someone is disqualified, another shall be chosen in his place by the same method. Those who pass the examination shall judge the cases of those who have fled the other courts, and shall cast their vote openly. The council members and the other officials who chose them shall of necessity be present as listeners and observers of these trials, and any other citizen who wishes may attend as well. If someone accuses another of having deliberately judged a case unjustly, let him bring the charge before the guardians of the laws. Whoever is convicted of such an offense must pay half the damages to the injured party, and if he is judged to deserve a greater penalty, the judges of the case shall assess, in addition, whatever else he ought to suffer or pay, both to the community and to the one who brought the suit. Concerning public charges, it is necessary first of all to give the mass of citizens a share in judgment, for whenever someone wrongs the city, everyone is wronged, and people would rightly resent being excluded from a share in such decisions. So both the beginning and the end of such a trial must be handed over to the people, while the sifting of the evidence shall be conducted by three of the most senior officials, agreed upon by defendant and prosecutor alike. And if the two cannot agree between themselves, the council shall decide on the choice for each. All citizens, so far as possible, must also share in private lawsuits, for whoever has no share in the power to help judge thinks he has no part at all in the city. For this reason, it is necessary that courts be established by tribe as well, with judges chosen by lot on the spot, incorruptible by appeals for favor, to judge the case, and that the final decision in all such matters rest with that court which we say has been made, so far as is humanly possible, the most incorruptible of all, for the benefit of those who cannot get satisfaction either from their neighbors or from the tribal courts. Now concerning courts, which we have said we cannot speak of definitively either as offices or as something other than offices, we have, so to speak, sketched an outline from the outside. Some things have been said, others left for later. For it would be most fitting for the precise legislation and division of the laws concerning lawsuits to come near the end of our lawgiving. Let this, then, be left to await us at the end, but the arrangements concerning the other offices have pretty much received the greater part of their legislation already. It is not possible for the whole and precise account concerning each and every administration of the city and of political affairs generally to become clear before the exposition, proceeding from the beginning, has taken up the secondary matters and the intermediate ones and all its own parts, and arrived at its conclusion. As things stand now, however, reaching as far as the selection of officials makes a sufficient stopping point for what has gone before, and there is no more reason to delay or hesitate before beginning the actual legislation of the laws.
Everything you have said before was entirely to my liking, stranger, and now that you have linked the beginning to an end for what has been said and what is yet to be said, you have spoken even more agreeably than before.
Then our thoughtful old men's game would have been well played, so far as we have played it now.
You seem to be revealing a fine seriousness in these men.
Naturally, but let us consider this next point, if you agree with me.
What point and about what?
You know how, with painters, the work never seems to reach an end for any single figure. There is always shading or highlighting, or whatever it is the sons of painters call such touches, and it never seems to stop being adorned, so that the picture can no longer improve and grow clearer.
I more or less follow what you mean, even though I have never been trained in that art myself.
And you've lost nothing by it. But let us make use of the point that has just come up for something like this. Suppose someone set out to paint the most beautiful living creature possible, and resolved that it should never grow worse, but only better as time goes on. Don't you see that, being mortal, unless he leaves behind a successor able to correct the figure if time makes it slip in any way, and able to fill in whatever was left out through his own weakness in the art, restoring and improving it into the future, all his great labor will last only a short while.
True.
Well then, doesn't the lawgiver's wish seem to you much the same? First, to write the laws with as much precision as he can manage. Then, as time goes on, and his intentions are tested in practice, do you think any lawgiver could be so foolish as not to know that a great many things are bound to be left out, things that someone must follow along and correct, so that the constitution and order of the city he has founded never grows worse, but always better?
Naturally, how could it be otherwise? Everyone would want that.
So if someone had some device for this, some way of teaching another, in deed and in word, whether to a greater or lesser degree, an understanding of how the laws should be guarded and corrected, he would never stop speaking of it before reaching the end, would he?
How could he?
Then is this not exactly what you and I must now do?
What do you mean?
Since we are about to legislate, and guardians of the laws have been chosen for us, and we are on the downward slope of life while they are young compared to us, we must, as we say, both legislate ourselves and at the same time try to make these very men, so far as possible, lawgivers and lawguardians in their own right.
Certainly, provided we are capable enough for it.
In any case, it must be attempted and pursued with eagerness.
Of course.
Let us say to them, then, dear preservers of the laws, in laying down laws on each matter, we will leave a great many things out. That is unavoidable. Yet, so far as we can, we will not leave the larger, essential matters undrawn, as it were, in outline. You will have to fill in what has been sketched. What you should keep your eyes on as you do this, you must hear. Megillus and I and Clanias have said this to one another not just once, and we agree it has been well put, and we want you to become both sympathetic judges of what we say and our students, keeping your eyes on the very things we have agreed with one another that the law guardian and lawgiver ought to keep in view. Our agreement had a single central point, that a person should somehow become good, possessing the excellence of soul proper to a human being, whether this comes from some practice, some habit of character, some kind of possession, desire, opinion, or course of study, whether the nature involved among those living together is male or female, young or old, every effort throughout the whole of life must be stretched toward this very thing we speak of, and nothing that stands in its way should be given honor by anyone, not even, in the end, the city itself. If it should truly become necessary for the city to be overthrown, rather than willingly submit to a slave's yoke under baser men, or else abandon the city in flight, all such things must be endured before adopting a form of government that by nature makes people worse. We agreed on these things earlier, and now, looking to both these standards, you praise and blame laws according to whether they can achieve them. The ones that succeed you welcome and take up gladly, living by them, but whatever else pursues other aims, however good it's called, deserves no more than a passing nod. Let the beginning of the laws that follow be this, starting from sacred matters. We must first go back to the number 5040 and recall all the useful divisions it has and had, both as a whole and by tribe, a 12th part of which we set at 21 times 20, exactly right. The whole number yields 12 divisions, and so does the tribal share. Each portion must be regarded as sacred, a gift of a god, following the months and the cycle of the whole heaven. That is why every city is naturally drawn to hold such things sacred, though some peoples have divided and consecrated the arrangement more correctly and successfully than others. We, at any rate, maintain that we have chosen most correctly the number 5040, which admits every division up through 12, starting from 1, except for 11, and even that flaw is easily healed, since if you take away two hearths, it becomes whole again on the other side. That this is really so, a lengthy account could show at leisure. For now, trusting the report and argument before us, let us make the division, assign to each portion a god or a child of a god, set up altars and their appropriate rites, and hold gatherings for sacrifices at them twice a month, 12 for the tribal division, 12 for the division of the city as a whole, first for the sake of the gods' favor and of matters concerning them, and second for our own sake, for kinship and mutual acquaintance, as we might say, and for fellowship of every kind. For when it comes to marriage and the mingling of families, it's essential to remove ignorance about the people one marries into and the woman one gives in marriage, and about those to whom one gives her, holding it of the greatest importance, as far as possible, never to go wrong in such things. For the sake of this seriousness, then, the games too should be arranged, boys and girls dancing together, and at the same time seeing and being seen, at an age that gives some plausible occasion, in reasonable dress, undressed only to the point each one's modesty allows. The directors and organizers of all this should be the leaders of the choruses, together with the lawgivers, acting as legislators alongside the guardians of the laws, wherever we ourselves leave gaps in our regulations. It's unavoidable, as we said, that in all such matters, small and numerous as they are, the lawgiver must leave things out, and that those who each year gain experience of them, learning from practice, must make the arrangements and correct them and adjust them year by year, until a sufficient standard for such customs and practices seems to have been reached. A period of 10 years, devoted to sacrifices and dances in general and applied to each and every one, would be a moderate and sufficient span for gaining this experience. While the lawgiver who set them up is alive, this is done in common with him. Once he is gone, each office should bring to the guardians of the laws whatever remains uncorrected from its own period, correcting it, until each practice seems to have reached its final, well-finished form. Then, having fixed them as unchangeable, they should use them from then on together with the other laws that the original lawgiver laid down. About these, no one should ever willingly alter anything, but if some necessity ever seems to demand it, all the officials must be consulted, the whole people, and every oracle of the gods, and only if all agree should any change be made, never otherwise, under any circumstances, and whoever opposes such a change should always prevail by law. Whenever any man who has reached the age of 25, looking into the matter himself, and being looked into by others, comes to believe he has found a match to his mind, and fitting for having and raising children, let him marry every such man before reaching 35. But first let him hear how he ought to seek what is fitting and suitable. For as Cleinias says, a fitting prelude belongs before every law addressed to each case.
You've remembered beautifully, stranger. You've seized just the right moment in the discussion, one that strikes me as perfectly measured.
Well said. So then, my boy, born of good parents, we should say you must make a marriage that wins approval among sensible people, who would advise you neither to shun marriage with the poor nor to chase after marriage with the rich above all, but rather, other things being equal, always to give preference to the humbler match in forming the union. This would benefit both the city and the households that come together, for the level and balanced is immeasurably better for virtue than the unmixed and extreme. And a man who knows himself to be more impulsive and quicker than he should be in all his actions ought to be eager to become son-in-law to sober parents, while a man of the opposite nature should move toward the opposite kind of in-laws. Let there be one single teaching for every marriage. Each man must court the marriage that benefits the city, not the one that is most pleasant to himself. For everyone by nature is somehow drawn toward his own likeness, and from this the whole city ends up uneven in wealth and in character, which brings about, in most cities, exactly what we do not want to happen to us. Now to command these things by law in so many words, that the rich should not marry the rich, nor a man of great influence marry into another such family, and to force the quick-tempered toward the slower, and the slow toward the quick, in forming marriages, besides being ridiculous, would stir up anger in many people. For it isn't easy to see that a city must be mixed like a mixing bowl, in which the wine, poured in raging, foams, but once disciplined by another, sober god, forms a good partnership and produces a fine and moderate drink. Hardly anyone is able to perceive that this same thing happens in the blending of children. For this reason, we must leave such matters to persuasion rather than law, trying by incantation to persuade each person to value the evenness of his children's characters more than the boundless equality of matched wealth in marriage, and to turn back with reproach anyone who is overly serious about money in marrying, rather than forcing him by written law. Let this stand as encouragement concerning marriages, along with what was said earlier, that one must hold fast to the everlasting nature by leaving behind children's children, forever handing over to the God servants in one's place. All this and more besides could be said as a proper prelude on how one ought to marry. But if someone still will not willingly obey, and instead keeps himself apart and unconnected within the city, remaining unmarried until he is 35, let him be fined every year. A man of the highest property class, 100 drachmas, of the second, 70, of the third, 60, of the fourth 30. Let this money be sacred to Hera. Whoever fails to pay each year shall owe 10 times as much. The treasurer of the goddess shall exact it, and if he fails to collect it, he himself shall owe it, and shall answer for it at his examination of accounts. So much for the fine in money laid on the man unwilling to marry. He shall also be deprived of all honor from the younger men, and no young man shall willingly obey him in anything. And if he tries to punish anyone, let everyone come to the aid of the one wronged and defend him, and let any bystander who fails to help be declared by law both a coward and a bad citizen. As for dowries, it has been said before, and let it be said again, that it suits equality best neither to receive nor to give a dowry, so that the poor are not left to grow old for lack of money. For in this city, the necessities are provided for everyone, and marriage will bring less arrogance and less base, servile submission on the wife's part on account of money. Whoever obeys this would be doing something noble, but whoever disobeys, whether giving or receiving more than 50 drachmas worth for clothing, or a mina for the second class, or a mina and a half, or 2 minas for the man of the highest property class, shall owe an equal sum to the public treasury, and whatever was given or received shall be sacred to Hera and Zeus. And the treasurers of these 2 gods shall exact it, just as was said of the treasurers of Hera exacting the fine from those who do not marry, each paying the penalty from his own funds. Let the right to give a woman in marriage belong first to her father, second to her grandfather, third to brothers by the same father. If none of these exist, then the right belongs likewise to those on the mother's side. And should some unusual circumstance arise, the nearest relatives in every case, together with the guardians, shall have the authority.